The Tom Woods Show, episode 2341.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. As the academic year winds down, it's time to start thinking about what you're going to do in the fall. And of course, I highly recommend the self-taught K through 12 Ron Paul curriculum. Not only will your kids get the real story about everything, but they'll also learn the kinds of practical things that they won't learn in the traditional school. For instance, how to be an effective public speaker, how to manage money, and how to run your own home business. And of course, when they reach the high school grades, they will be learning Western civilization and U.S. government from old Tom Woods here. But here's the most important thing. If you're going to join, make sure you join through my link, because only through my link do you get $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm doing something a little unusual for today's episode, but over the weekend, I had a really, really great session. Or actually, was it the weekend? It was Monday. It was Memorial Day. I had a great session with a guy named Jared Casey, whom you've heard before. He is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at University College Dublin, author of some terrific books. I mentioned a couple of them in my introduction to him that you're about to hear. He is a faculty member at libertyclassroom.com. And for the master members and basic plus members, every month we do a live Q&A in addition to the on-demand courses. And this month's Q&A was just so good that I thought, doggone it, this needs to be heard beyond just the range of my members at libertyclassroom.com. So I want you to hear it. So these are member-supplied questions that are being asked of us in real time in a chat window while Jared and I are talking. And I think you'll get a kick out of it. We cover quite a wide array of topics. So here we go.
First, I want to explain myself a little bit to everybody. I don't normally appear in a baseball cap and a t-shirt, but I'm trying to fit everything in today because the family and I are going to Boston tomorrow. So I'm just coming back from the gym and I did not have time to take a shower. So you are not going to see how I look underneath this thing. That's just not happening. I don't care what membership level you're at. You're not entitled to that benefit. But we have Professor Casey here with us. We're going to be ready to answer your questions as best we can. I will pledge to you that next month we're going to do a Q&A on the general subject of economic topics. So bring your economics questions to the one coming up in June. So now that we've said that, greetings from Dublin. Are you also in Dublin, Brendan Ward? Or are you saying that Professor Casey brings his greetings from Dublin, which indeed he does? All right, well, that'll be it. So you have an instant friend now.
What can I say?
Why don't we give him your address and phone number? Okay. All right, you ready? let's get going. So folks, if you have questions, notice that we have a Q&A only tab. Please use that for the questions. And we have Brendan Ward is there in Dublin. Well, I was just saying, as we're waiting for you folks to submit your questions, I'll say we just had a brief conversation about my travels and that I had an Ireland trip all lined up for November of 2020. And the bastards took it away from me. So I hope maybe we will be able to revisit that in 2024. Well, let me ask you this. What do you think about, everybody talks about going to Ireland. I mean, in the United States, everybody wants to go to Ireland. That's partly because we have so many people of Irish descent here, but also because it sounds like a fun place to go. But what about, now forget the politics, what about as a vacation destination? What about Northern Ireland?
Northern Ireland is fine. Perfect. Yeah. Maybe okay. Even better. I mean, prices might even be lower. I can't keep up with all the changes now, right? We've been suffering from the kind of more or less dramatic price rises that everybody's been suffering from. And as we've taken in 100,000 immigrants in the last year, okay, in a society whose infrastructure wasn't up to it before that. That's caused some problems. So, for example, many hotels have been, I don't know what would you call it, appropriated, as it were. And of course, that reduces the amount. And so prices have risen.
Right, even more, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you really do need to check. But Ireland's fine. But one thing I would say, of course, is that Ireland isn't Dublin. So yeah. By all means, come to Dublin and so on. And look around. There's lots to see here. But do get out into the country.
What I think I would do, honestly, is two separate trips. Because yeah. I can only get over there for a week at a time. And I want to just do everything I possibly can in Dublin for a week. And then have a trip where I rent a car and I drive around.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, public transport is reasonably good. from kind of main cities to main cities, not to smaller places. You really do need a car to get there. I mean, you can get there by bus, but it means like, who knows? Waiting for the donkey to turn up, who knows when it's going to happen?
Let's go over to the questions. Much as I would love to talk about world travel. Okay. All right. So let's start with your book, Libertarian Anarchy. And if my books were organized in any reasonable way, I'd be able to pull it off my shelf right now. But when I moved into this new house after it was built, I just threw those books there on the shelf with no rhyme or reason to it. But it is a great book. It's a short, easily digestible book full of interesting and challenging ideas. And the question is, are there any parts of that book that you would like to revise?
Ooh, that's a good question. The short answer is no, but there are a lot of parts where I'd like to go on at greater length. It's a book in a series, and so there were series constraints, and I had a maximum word limit of, I think, something like 65 to 70,000 words. And so that really constrained what I wanted to do. So a lot of people commenting on it said, you know, this is very short. It's good, but it's very, very short. And I keep saying, well, that's not my fault. Don't blame me.
I've been there.
Yeah, I know. Mind you, working under constraints is not a bad idea. When I was at graduate school, one of the hardest papers I ever had to write was for one of my professors called Ken Sayre. And he said, 3,000 words, not a single word more. This is before we had, obviously, word counters and so on. And my God, I sweated over that. And when I was running my course in anarchy law in the state, I gave my students a weekly assignment to do 300 words and no more. And one of the things it does is you can't waffle.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. No waffling, no easing into the subject, no easing out of the subject.
And none of those classic, like, high school, middle school, freshman year sentences like, I thought this book was very challenging and introduced many interesting ideas, and interesting ideas are very important.
Well, my favorite one was, before I can answer that, I have to, and then follows, I don't know, tell all of the interesting incidents in my life from the age of two, omitting no detail, however slight.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Okay. In your book, what is the name of your book on history of political thought?
Oh, Freedom's Progress.
Freedom's Progress. Yeah, Freedom's Progress. Question mark. Did you talk about the Putney debates? I seem to remember.
Yes,
that.
I did.
Okay. Can you, because we have a question about that. Can you explain what they were about and which side you think had the better of the argument?
Okay. Well, the Putney, it was sort of very interesting. This is in the context of the English Civil War, or the War of the Three Kingdoms, as it's called now, a more politically correct term, I suppose. And when the parliamentary army had won, I think probably to their surprise, the next question is, it's like, when you win the revolution, what do you do now? Okay. So what do we do? So in Putney, the leaders of the army, and then the, not so much the leaders of the rank and file, but the lower grade officers and so on, met for a discussion as to what was to be done. And the issue really came down to this. The participants was a man called Henry Ireton, who was Cromwell's son-in-law afterwards, who died, by the way, in Irish campaign at the age of 40. And I can't remember the name of the celebrated person on the other side. I'd have to actually go back and look it up in my book. But it came down to this. The rank and file and the lower grade officers said something like as follows. They said, we've given up our liberty. We've given up our time. We've risked our lives for this. And whatever decision we come to, we don't want to find ourselves in exactly the same situation we were in before we did all that. Things have got to change. And one of the things that's got to change is that we've got to get some kind of representation. And the reason for that was they said, if you live in a kingdom and you live under its laws, then you really should have some say in who it is makes the laws that you live under. That's one side. The other side, ably articulated by Henry Ireton, said as follows, well, that's all very well, but the representatives you elect are going to have the ability to levy taxes, and taxes are an imposition on property. And therefore, if there are a significant number of people who are electing those people who levy the taxes, who themselves are not susceptible to having those taxes levied on them, you're going to have a situation where people are actually able to make use of other people's property for their own ends. And that's not unreasonable. I'm actually sympathetic to both sides. Of course, the problem there is the whole idea of representation, okay, which both of them agreed on. They simply couldn't figure out how it went. It's not unreasonable if you're going to be represented that you have some say in electing your representatives. If you're going to be stuck with laws, that you have some way of determining who it is that gets to make those laws. On the other hand, if you're going to end up funding the whole thing, okay, you would say, well, I mean, if there's a whole bunch of people out there who are net tax beneficiaries and not payers, it's going to be problematic if they do it. This is actually quite contemporary if you think about it, because, of course, in contemporary societies, and they couldn't have foreseen this in the 17th century, a significant number of people are actually net tax beneficiaries. And of course, they're quite happy to elect people who are going to levy taxes on those who are going to pay the taxes, who are not them, and then redistribute it to them. And that was Ireton's point. He said, no man's property is safe in a situation like that. And how right he was. Okay. So as I said, I'm sympathetic to both sides, but the problem there is caused really by what they have in common, which is that they had to be some system of representation. And that representation is a figment of people's imagination.
Have you ever met Paul Gottfried? Do you know who he is?
Yes. In fact, I was going to say, I listened to your discussion with him from start to finish. He is a person I highly respect and esteem. He's a remarkable chap. And, yeah. And yes, I have met him and I've had long conversations with him and so on. Yes. So that was a very, very, I don't want to sound like the sophomore student. That was a really interesting discussion.
Yeah, I loved that conversation.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about it. Do you mind if I make a comment on that?
Please do. And in the meantime, I'll put a link to it in the chat so people know what we're talking about.
Well, here's the situation. I often think, so if you're a libertarian, as I am and you are, we would like to live ideally in a society which is libertarian through and through. We are not there. We're not near being there. We're 100 million miles from there, right? And so whether we like it or not, we are where we are. And so the question is, although we know what we'd like to be and to do in a fully libertarian society, we're not there. And so the question is, what do you do in the interim? Now, it seems to me that there are two principles that should guide a libertarian in thinking about this. One is, the first principle should be that we should try to get to the libertarian situation as quickly as possible. That's the first one. The second principle, however, is orthogonal and crosses it. And it says we should get there with the least disruption. Okay? Because if you were to push a button in the morning, you would have anarchism in the vulgar sense of the term, which is disorder. And so if you adhere to one of those to the exclusion of the other, for example, if you said with the least disorder as possible, then we'd get there in 55 million years, which is to say never. Okay. And if you said as quickly as possible, we're going to have chaos. So the question then is, for a libertarian, what can you do? What can you legitimately do without abandoning your libertarian principles in a situation? And the answer is, I don't know, but it's a prudential decision. So let me give an example from another area to illustrate what I mean. Suppose you were already a legislator in some legislative body, and abortion was available, say, with a limit of, say, 22 weeks or something like this. And a proposal was made to lower it to 20. Could you vote for that? Could you support it? And my answer is yes, obviously. Okay. Because what you're doing is you're minimizing an existing evil. The evil is not of your making. And here you're going to limit it. Does that mean you've compromised your principles? That means you are for this? And the answer is no. Okay. But if you're going to live in a kind of purist world where it's like all or nothing, you're going to have to take what you can get from the position in which you start. In the immortal words of West Side Story, you want to live in this lousy world? Okay. This is the only world we can live in. But here, you also have to avoid the problem. I mean, what Rothbard called becoming a beltway libertarian. This is the young guy who is like enthused with libertarian principles and then goes off to Washington and gradually becomes part of the dinner party circuit and the cocktail circuit. And after 5 years, he looks back on how he thought 5 years previously. And he goes, oh my gosh, I was so romantic and so naive. And now he's into nitty gritties of tiny little movements. Not as a way forward to some goal, but he's forgotten and abandoned the goal completely. Anyway, sorry, that was what I was thinking about when you were talking to Paul.
I certainly know the type you're talking about. They've forgotten and abandoned the goal. Now they just want to signal to everybody how respectable they are. They're a little cheeky because they are a little bit more for free trade than the New York Times is or something. But other than that, they're just to scold the rest of us who don't care about respectability.
That's pretty radical.
Yeah. Well, I bring this up because we have a question relating to Paul, who, by the way, he's 81 now.
Wow.
When he was 79, he was riding his bike and he was hit by a car and tumbled. I mean, he was hit on his bike by a car and went tumbling off it and had to get, you know, he had broken ribs and unbelievable. He made a full recovery.
Wow.
And by bizarre coincidence, the doctor who was working with him or operated on him happened to be a listener of my podcast and so wrote to let me know that Paul was doing fine, which I'm sure violated some law. But you know, back in the normal days, this would have been considered normal that a doctor would tell you that Paul is doing fine.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, it's like, you know, Rick, when he was conscious before he was operated on after his assassination attempt and asked the doctor, he hoped he was a Republican.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, anyway, so Paul, according to this question, recently reviewed some of his favorite thinkers. And they include people like Arthur Schopenhauer, Friedrich Julius Stahl, Joseph de Maistre, Juan Donoso Cortez. Are there any of these in particular that are appealing to you that you might mention to us or that repay study?
No, two of them I don't know at all. As Joseph de Maistre, I do know a little bit and so on. But Arthur Schopenhauer, yes, because I might be the only one in Ireland who has, I think, read The World as Will and Representation. Okay, Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer is an interesting character. He was, I don't know if you know the story, but he set himself up against Hegel and he scheduled his lectures at the same time and he lost out. Okay. So
nothing ventured, nothing
at least nothing was gained. Yeah.
An effort. Yeah.
He was at, well, what they call it in Germany, Privatdozent, the private teacher, because anyone with PhD or with a doctorate could actually offer a course. And if students came, they paid and you made some money. But if they didn't, you didn't make any. So yeah, he was a Privatdozent and he lost out on that one. But his idea of, if you like, will is interesting. That he, like many philosophers in the 19th century, many philosophers through the ages, he picked on one thing which he thought was, if you like, the essence or the core of reality. And it was this sort of notion of will. I would think it influenced people like Nietzsche and everything that sort of followed. He was also probably the only Western philosopher of any note, certainly before the 20th century, who thought Eastern thought from China and India was worth paying attention to. Okay, and you see elements of it in his work. So yeah, definitely, Schopenhauer repay study. Not the easiest person to read, I have to say. And you might want to read, I don't know, the easy version first, the potted version before you actually tackle one of the big books, but yes. Joseph de Maistre, I know more by repute than by actually reading his material. If I get it correctly, he was a Catholic thinker, 19th century French, who, what was his central idea? Would he be a sort of an early version of kind of Christian nationalism, would you think? Would that be correct?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, when I was trying to figure things out, I did look into him a little bit because I basically thought, anybody the modern world despises, I want to look into. That was my philosophy. But this was over 30 years ago.
Mm. I'm in pretty much the same situation. This isn't helping, unfortunately, the person who asked the question. So really, I'm a bit of a loss here. But yes, Schopenhauer, definitely. And I suspect on the same principle that you're operating on, if everybody is against him, I'm probably for him. There's probably something in there worth looking at, something that's maybe not in its totality, but certainly something that would give you a different angle on the world in which we live.
Now, of course, I mean, I guess one of his central points that I think would be considered quite unfashionable in the modern world would be that political authority has a religious derivation and that it doesn't come from, quote, the will of the people or whatever. And I know a lot of people would obviously recoil at that. And yet, the idea that all power comes from the consent of the governed and the popular will, where have these ideas actually in practice gotten us? I know that in principle, they sound really nice. Because, oh, okay, well, then that means we'll have some input into what goes on. And yet, you and I have literally zero input into the world we live in. I mean, I live in a world that every single thing the political authorities do is absolutely hostile to everything I believe in. And yet, I'm told that the will of the people is the driving. It obviously isn't. So I don't see how it could be worse under Joseph de Maistre. How could it be? Maybe they might accidentally do the right thing under the system.
Well, the will of the people,
they don't even accidentally do the right thing.
The will of the people, of course, is a secular version of the will of God.
Yeah.
Right? And that's effectively, it's simply bringing it down to earth, literally, and so on. But however we might come to know the will of God, and we have some indications of how we might do that, the systems we have in place now, because democracy is the God that failed, as one of a person we both know has written about, said, there's no way. I mean, so I get this all the time. The people have decided this, and I go, when did they do that? The only possible way in any democracy where you could even begin to make some sense of the will of the people is in the case of a referendum. But even there, the odds are stacked because generally the question is crude and it's kind of a sort of a yes no situation. But that's about it. When it comes to elections, I mean, so I'll give you a concrete example. So Leo Varadkar, who's our current prime minister here in Ireland, when they were campaigning back, I think it was in 2016, we have lots of taxes, but one really nasty one is called the USC, the Universal Social Charge. And it's a flat 3 or 4 or 5% tax on all your income before they ever get to put your income tax on. Right. And he said, his minister for finance said, this is a terrible tax. It was an emergency. The emergency's over. We need to get rid of it. So 7 years on, we're still here. We've still got the USC. Ooh, that's a bit of a surprise. Okay. Why is it a surprise? Because, of course, the promises, the platforms your representatives stand on, that's even if they have any, I don't commit them anything. You don't commit them to anything. You can't sue them if they don't carry them out. They're not bound in any way by them. They can simply make any deal they want, do anything they want. And the only time you actually have any kind of say is to be one vote among millions in an election, which, of course, is effectively meaningless, as we know. So there's a problem. So the whole idea of, I mean, I've written about this, the whole idea of representation, of course, is nonsense through and through.
The second you said that, I had it ready to go. I clicked enter and it's now in the chat, the link to what you've written about political representation being an absurd idea. Not an absurd idea like it would be stupid to try. It's that the idea of it is meaningless.
Yeah. And by the way, it's not that I'm pointing the fickle finger of scorn at people who genuinely, but mistakenly, think that they can kind of engage in public service. It's just not really possible to do it. I mean, let's take a simple example. Suppose you are in a constituency which elects one member and there are 100,000 electors and you get 50,001 votes. You will be elected. Okay. Well, what about the 49,999 people who didn't vote for you? They didn't want you to represent them. But now, whether they like it or not, you are their representative. And on almost any question, there might be a few questions where you would have complete unanimity among the 100,000 electors. But on almost any other question, you're going to have a divide. And so your so-called representative of the 100,000 is going to have to represent some and not the others. And not because he's mean or nasty, but because of the nature of what he's doing. It's simply not possible in any meaningful sense of representation to represent more than a very small number, and then only when there's a clear line of indicating how somebody is to represent you, what those powers are, who is the principal and agent, and so on. And I've gone through this in various ways of talking about it. But this is a kind of fairy story we tell us to justify democracy, representative democracy. But as I said about representative democracy, it's a bit like the Holy Roman Empire, which is neither Holy Roman nor an empire. Representative democracy is neither representative nor democracy.
And not to mention, I think that the language about the people's consent, I think that's just cover. I think it's you who have just put it this way. The brute fact is that some people rule and other people are ruled.
Yeah,
that's and funny. The ruling classes have to cover that over somehow. And they cover it over with pretty language about the consent of the people. But it doesn't really mean much. Okay.
But they've always done this, Tom. In other words, I mean, in earlier age, they would have said they were either God's representatives or they were actually gods of various kinds and so on. And that's why you were supposed to obey them. Okay. Or because in more robust ages when we didn't have this false equality, because they were superior to you and they were aristocrats. Okay. And they knew more about it than you do and had more power and were better kind of people and so on. And you were just plebs. So yeah, there's always a cover story, but some rule and some are ruled.
Let's see. Are you familiar? I'm not, but are you aware of the Orania community in South Africa? And is it an effective example of small-scale peaceful secession?
I did actually read something about this, but it was quite a while ago, 3 or 4 years. And I looked it up at the time. And I'm desperately trying to recall the details. I wasn't able to make up my mind at the time. It looked like a runner. Okay, if I remember rightly, it was a group of people who had bought a significant bunch of land and were sort of living it, sort of like a kind of latter-day Amish group, except they weren't necessarily Christians and so on. But I can't really answer that question because I don't know even if it's still in existence. And it would be interesting to track it down and check up on it to see if there have been any kind of developments or has it gone the way of the kind of Israeli kibbutzim.
Yeah, so I will look this up as soon as we finish. Somebody wants to know, has there been any pushback from the Irish people with regard to the immigrants? that you're talking about?
The answer is yes. Okay. And in fact, one of our Sunday newspapers yesterday published a poll, a Red Sea poll, so a respectable polling company, as respectable as a polling company can be, which says 75% of the people think there are too many. Okay. Now, consistently, our politicians have been describing anybody who raises any question, however temperate and nuanced, about the advisability of bringing in large numbers of people into a situation where the infrastructure simply cannot support them, so that we had people living in tents on the streets in Dublin. Okay, not desirable by anybody's standards. So the political establishment simply engaged in name calling and vituperation. We are far right, and so on. So I put up a tweet yesterday saying, okay, isn't it interesting that 75% of the people in Ireland belong to the far right? Who would have guessed? Oh, by the way, can I do a little plug for my Twitter here?
I'll put your Twitter in the...
Yeah, if you would. So, and for anyone who's interested, I have a Twitter account. And so it's at Casey, that's my name, C-I-S-E-Y, and then 5122, dark.
I don't know why you chose that, but I'm sure you had a reason.
I did. And the reason is very simple. It has to do with my date of birth and the year I took up Twitter, my name in front of it, of course. And my first tweet was, I have gone over to the dark side.
Okay, it makes sense. I just put the link in there. So even if you're not on Twitter, just you can click it and view Professor Casey's feed, his tweets.
Nothing sinister about it. Okay, some of my Christian friends were a bit puzzled and a bit worried. And I said, no, it's just a joke.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, I like your Twitter, by the way. It's a good one. Okay, how about your massive book? Again, I wish I... Actually, that one, Freedom's Progress book, is actually by my bedside. That's why.
Good. It's weird along. Very good sleep.
No, that's not why. But I remember we did a whole bunch of episodes.
We did.
Because I could just take a chapter or we could do an episode on it. But see, now it's been so long since you wrote it, you'd have to do all this prep if I invited you to do that again.
Well, I'd have to read it again as if it was written by somebody else.
I know. I love that. Years later, because I have books that are 15, almost 20 years old, and I reread them and I think, and I am very relieved to tell you that I think, this ain't half bad.
Well, I've had that experience, and it sounds like vanity, but you find yourself saying, geez, that's really good. I wish I'd said that. And you go, but I did say that.
I did say it.
I had an embarrassing episode, actually, Tom, where I had an article published and a chap wrote to me about 5 years later, asked me a question about it. And I had to write back. And I know this, I must have sounded really bizarre when I said, listen, I'm really sorry, but the whole mindset and my whole study and investigation and my project at the time surrounded this paper. And I've moved on from it. And I am reading, I could read, if I gave you an answer now, it would be the answer of somebody reading the paper from the outside. I have no special authoria access to it anymore.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's a bizarre thing. And I've been thinking, we'll get back to the question in a second, but I've just been thinking so much lately about the limitations of human beings, because I've been reading a lot about AI.
Me too.
And how incredibly stupid, if AI ever really were to be able to quote unquote think, how stupid it would think we are. Because it can learn a foreign language like by tomorrow morning. It's taking me years to learn foreign languages. Years. Or it could master all of political thought in a day, if not less. And yet we celebrate and honor professors who, at the end of their careers, have begun to approach mastery of these things, you know? And so I think about that when I go back and look at my own books. I think, what would AI think of this? That I'm going back impressed by my own books because I don't remember what's in them.
Well, I'm actually giving a short talk on AI to a group in a couple of weeks. And just for fun, I went on ChatGPT and I typed in, what are the dangers of AI? And in 15 seconds, it gave me 8. Right? So what I'm going to do, what I'm planning to do, so I hope nobody who's going to be at the talk is listening to this, right? So I'm going to print that out and say, here you are, right? And what do you think about all of these, right? And then when they've had a chance to take it, I'm going to say, you know where I got all of this? From AI.
Yeah.
It is remarkable. But I'm not...
Brendan Ward, who is your fellow Dublinian, shows up to this event. He's not going to spoil your punch.
He's not better not pull the rug from under me. No, yeah. Anyway, so it's fun. But it is extraordinary, and I don't know what to make it. In fact, my project, if I can get back to it, and it'll probably be the last thing of substance I ever do, is on transhumanism and AI. And I've been thinking about this for well over a year now, and I should either, you know, get up and do it or stop talking about it and just quit. I'm not sure where I stand on it at the moment, but there we are.
Now, let's get back to the questions, although in the chat, I'm now going to put one more link. I had a guy on my podcast just a couple of days ago named Stephen Wolfram, who is, when you find out who this guy is, it's incredible I got him on the Tom Woods Show, but he is an absolute giant in this field. I mean, he had his PhD at the age of 20. He's one of these incredible prodigies. And it's exactly as I said, he's an incredible prodigy, and AI would think he was like an alligator. Well,
just to give you one example before we leave this, I mean, so you and I, we played a chess game together once and so on. So I'm a keen but very mediocre chess player. So when the chess engines came out first, they were simply brute force. I mean, effectively what had happened is that somebody had fed modern chess openings into them, okay, and so on and so forth. So they were incredibly strong, but they didn't play like human beings. So you ended up, we now have all of these things improved. So we have Stockfish and others, and the ones that they use for the Grandmaster Championships and the World Championships and so on. But about a year ago, they came up with a program, and all they gave this program were the rules of chess, nothing else. Mm. And in about 3 hours, it had reached a stage where it could beat all of the strongest engines.
Yeah, that's insane.
It had, through iterations and so on, without any input of strategies or openings or anything else, it had reached a stage where it could beat the strongest chess engines. Now, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
Terrifying. Yeah. If you're not terrified by this, you're not paying attention. I don't know what to say. It's just baffling. Why do I feel redundant all of a sudden?
I know. I don't know what to say about it. I mean, I used to think when I was younger that I was kind of a hotshot intellectually, you know, like I could grasp things quickly. I could be a reasonably strong chess player. But on the other hand, if the human mind designed that very thing that we're now marveling at. I mean, there is that.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that we can hold that kind of flattering unction to our soul for very long. It's not much of a consolation.
Well, it's all I've got. And that's what
I can say. It's all I've got and so on. I mean, you know, my whole life has been like yours in a sense, dedicated to learning and study and writing and so on and so forth. When you get to the end of your life, as I am approaching it rapidly now, more rapidly than I'm probably prepared for, and you kind of look back and think, everything I've done my entire life, which led up to it, all the study and the sweat and all of the agonizing thing about writing a book and so on, could be done probably indistinguishably by a machine. And I'm thinking, oh dear, I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah. I like to think I'm more lovable, however.
Well, I was going to say that I hope God loves me still, right? Okay. I'm kind of certain of it, not because of my incredible lovingness, okay, lovability rather, okay, but simply because, what can I say? God is a sucker when it comes to human beings.
Yeah. Just thank well. Goodness.
Hey, folks, some very quick Father's Day advice from our friends at Omaha Steaks. Number one, do not wait until the last minute to get your father a nice gift. But secondly, get him something he's actually going to enjoy and something he's definitely not expecting. Some juicy steaks and other goodies from Omaha Steaks. Head over to omahasteaks.com. Use promo code WOODS at checkout and get $30 off your qualifying order. Packages for dad can include bacon-wrapped filet mignons or other gourmet grillables like their boneless chicken breasts, juicy burgers, jumbo franks, and by the way, a hot dog is not a sandwich, but don't get me started. Many more favorites available too. Plus, save room for dessert. Most gift packages come with 4 delicious caramel apple tartlets. The Woods family has been ordering Omaha Steaks for at least a dozen years. It's super convenient, great value, and excellent quality. Plus, he'll be the envy of all the other dads. Well, whether he's your father, father-in-law, or father figure, get him something he really wants because dads want steak. Order today and get $30 off with promo code WOODS. That's promo code WOODS at omahasteaks.com. Minimum order may be required. See site for details.
All right, let's go back to the questions. What I started to say was, in your big book, you're talking about the history of political thought. Our natural instinct, though, as Westerners, is to treat Western political thought.
Yeah.
But is there anything in Eastern philosophy that is not altogether inimical to liberty. Like, we read a lot about Eastern philosophy being collectivist and so on and so forth. But is there anything you can comment on there, including Russian thought? Because it's Russia kind of straddles the worlds.
Yes, I can. I actually taught Eastern philosophy for 30 years.
Did you really?
You didn't know that, right? Okay, it's a dark secret and so on. But largely from the Chinese point of view, Confucianism, Taoism, right? And then in the Indian tradition, Hinduism and Buddhism, and with some digressions to some of the so-called heresies, Hindu heresies and so on. And the answer is yes. And in fact, in the preface to my Freedom's Progress, one of the points I make, because C. Norcott Parkinson was one of these people, the author of Parkinson's Law, by the way, a serious scholar, said, you know, one of the things that typically Westerners do is they talk about the history of philosophy, and it's always Western philosophy, and they never pay any attention beyond it. And there were three other sins that you could commit as well, which you link. And I would say, look, I'm going to focus on Western thought here, but that's not because I have no regard for, or do not, if you like, value the contributions of Eastern thought. It's simply that I'm not competent enough to say anything that I could stand over in a scholarly way. And that's still true. So that being said, the answer is yes, in both. So let's focus on the Chinese for a moment. I don't know much about Russian thought, right? But the Indian, yes, and the Chinese especially, which is very attractive. So in Taoism, one of the key principles of Taoism is Wu Wei. And it's translated sometimes into English as doing by not doing. Okay. It really comes to something like non-aggressive action. And here the idea is that if you really want something and you go at it bullheaded and so on, the chances are that you will set up resistance to what it is that you aim to achieve, okay, which will have the effect of preventing you actually from getting what you want, okay? Even in Confucian thought, which for many years, of course, was the dominant kind of ideology of the Chinese Empire, if I remember right, again, quoting from memory, you see, if I was AI now, I wouldn't have to quote from memory, right? According from memory, it says, the ideal ruler is like the North Pole star around which everything else turns. And that is surprisingly Taoist in its implications. The idea is that the ruler rules not by hyperactivity, not by passing reams and reams of legislation that kind of bend the shelves in the library, but by allowing others to turn and move around it, and by nudging whenever he needs to do it, as it were, but very, very, and so on, and not setting up resistance. So yeah, I mean, if one was able to do it, and I don't have the original languages, and you really would need to have them in order to do it. But my guess is, from the little that I do know, there is a plentiful supply of material there of, that should be of great interest to thinkers in the West. And that would sometimes, I would imagine, run across what we think and sometimes run with it. So, for example, many aspects of Confucianism run very close to what I know about Aristotle, both in ethics and politics. So, yeah, the answer, sorry, that's a long-winded answer. The answer is yes.
So for this question, I'm going to add my own little commentary in here. So in the last talk, and I'm probably referring to your course, you referred to Locke as an Aristotelian. But Don Livingston seems to insist that due to his ideological approach to social contract theory, as well as belief in the state of nature, technically makes him a Hobbesian. It may be just his Humean perspective, but do you think he may have a point? Well, I mean, I thought that because Aristotle thinks of politics as, quote, natural to man and the state as natural, whereas Locke views it as sort of a constructivist way that we could live without it. It's just that there are certain inconveniences.
That's right.
And of course, inconveniences had a stronger meaning in his day than it does now. But it was conceivable to think of human life before it. But then we came together and created it. Seems different from Aristotle's approach.
Yeah, I may have said this. I can't remember it. Here we go again. Okay. So
okay. I'm not sure. AI, Jared Casey would be able to immediately go back.
Oh, what can I say? The new, improved, and better looking version. But yeah, I mean, you could argue all of these things. And again, like, one of the favorite games that philosophers play is detecting influences in other philosophers. So people say, oh, I can see such and such in Hegel, and I can see so and so. And other people say, no, no, I can see this other different person in Hegel and whatever. And chances are, yes. I mean, there are bound to be similarities and differences. And to some extent, it's a matter of, I don't mean to trivialize it, but it's a sort of matter of taste and what you think important, what it is that you see witnessed in other philosophers. I would now, regardless of what I said, if I said it, I would be inclined to think of Locke as a constructivist and so on, and not as following the kind of the Aristotelian central idea that the polis, which by the way is not the state in the modern sense, because there we have a problem again, right? Because by Greek standards, I mean, England, which is a small country, would have been like a mega, mega, mega country. I mean, Athens was the largest of the Greek polis, of which there were nearly 200. And it was about a third of the size of County Cork, which is where I come from. Okay. Today it would be regarded as something like Liechtenstein, okay, or tiny. And the idea was you were really supposed to be in a situation where it was in principle possible for you to know all of your fellow citizens. So it was almost like a limited company or a company with like a small membership where you knew everybody and therefore you could have homonoia, as Aristotle would say. You could have the sameness of mind, right? And I defy anybody to find any modern state where homonoia is a characteristic.
True indeed. Okay, how about this question? Do you believe that if we are to overthrow the powers that shouldn't be, will it be in a gradual way or one giant change? Good question.
It is a good question. And the answer, I don't know. But I have a problem. I mentioned this actually earlier when I was talking about the conflicting, the orthogonal approaches to change. How do we arrive at a libertarian world? And the trouble is that the world in which we live has been constructed so that there are sort of various layers, right? And they're almost like a tower. And if you are to, as it were, blow it up, you get a lot of debris and a lot of dust and chaos. So I would be in favor personally of deconstructing, bringing it down layer by layer until eventually you've arrived and so on. And the final, so the top layer would be the latest one where governments were actually engaging directly in business activities or whatever it might be, and things well outside their remit. The second level, which would have to come down, would be something like health, education, and welfare, all of which are handled better by human beings making these arrangements themselves. And by the way, which also consume, I don't know what the situation is in the USA, but here, health, education, and welfare consumes well over 50% of our tax money. It's huge. It's never ending. It's a gaping hole. It's a money pit. No matter how much money you put into it, the situation never seems to improve. The services never seem to improve. Education is a disaster. Health is hit and miss, to put it mildly, and so on. And welfare simply creates a dependent class, okay, and removes some of the any notion of sort of dignity and worth. And then the final thing you'd be left with, of course, is law, justice, and security, which is the traditional justification for the state, that without it, you're going to have bandits roaming around and so on, but let's have one set of bandits instead of many. Okay. And the trouble there is that if somebody said to me in the morning, if you could push a button and get rid of all the layers of government except law, justice, and security, would you do it? And I'd say in a heartbeat. Okay. Because that would be a vast improvement over what we have now. Would I be content to stay there? No, but I would be able to remain there for quite a significant number of time before moving on if it came to that.
I think about this a lot. Now, Rothbard seemed to think that the gradual approach is very unlikely because he says that it's an improper analogy to say that interventionism came about gradually, so therefore anti-interventionism can come about gradually. Interventionism comes about gradually. You're going with the grain. You're going in the direction the state wants to go anyway. There's no guarantee that that same approach will work in reverse because every single step you take, you are fighting against everything there is. So maybe it does have to be one big catastrophic event that brings it about. In the 19th century in the U.S., we had numerous examples of what were known as utopian communities. And I don't think of libertarianism as a utopia. Our enemies portray it that way, and it just shows they're not listening. But the idea behind these utopian communities was that they're not going to try politically to change the entire country. They're going to set up a small community, and they're going to be so happy and prosperous that everyone will look at them and say, we want to be like them.
Yeah.
And they'll just spontaneously do that. The problem was none of these communities lasted more than 2 years. The communities themselves failed was the problem.
Robert Owens, one of those guys.
Yeah, it's that time period. Exactly. Yeah. 1830s, 40s, right around then. But they went all about it all wrong. Their communities were based on principles that they couldn't possibly adhere to for any period of time anyway. But I've sometimes thought about if there could be some tiny chunk of the world where we could live the way we want to live, and maybe we could set an example for others, I'd be willing to give that a try. But I wonder if we would wind up fighting with each other all the time over minutiae. Like, for instance, I'll give you an example. It has nothing to do with libertarianism, but I think it tells us something about human nature. There is a traditional Catholic chapel in New Jersey that one of my friends used to go to, and they got everything they had ever been asking for. Everything they had ever been asking for in this chapel. They got the Mass the way they wanted it. They got all the sacraments in the traditional pre-Vatican II rites. They had everything they wanted. Everything they wanted. And they were still fighting, because then the fight was when they would do the prayers after Mass that Leo XIII instituted, the same Michael the Archangel prayer.
Right.
Some of them prayed it one way with one translation, some prayed with the other, and this became a massive blow-up over something they had never fought about before, never fought about before. Everybody just said it their own way, and it didn't matter. But there was just always something to fight about, and it's like they're their own worst enemy. So I wonder if we would succumb to that. I don't even know.
Who knows? I mean, it's not a non-viable option in principle. In practice, I suggest it probably is. And just to continue with the church example, because here in Ireland, the Catholicism, institutional Catholicism, has imploded. And we are already in my own parish and so on. They are now planning for scaling down. I mean, the church I go to on a Sunday morning was built in the 1950s for probably a congregation of something like 1,200. Okay, there are maybe, at any given Mass on the Sunday morning, somewhere to 80 to 100 if you're lucky. Okay, so it's kind of, we're racketing around in this gigantic structure. And the same thing is happening in all the other churches. So we're planning for, if you like, planned obsolescence, all of these things are coming together. But at the same time, on Saturday, I was with a person who, since the year about 2000, has set up a model of a domestic church. This is not a paraliturgy. It's not unorthodox. He's not fighting anybody, but he sees the future and saw it then. And this is even like, this is 20 years ago. So he's not doing it just to react to current circumstances, to give a voice, as it were, to the domestic side of Catholicism and growth in prayer and holiness and so on and so forth, not just to address the current problems, but as something that should have been done anyway and was neglected. And I went there expecting to be, well, unimpressed, and I was actually impressed by it. So who knows? Who can say?
Let's see. Do you think, first of all, I can explain it very quickly. It might not even be known in Ireland, but are you familiar with quote-unquote agorism and what that is?
Yes.
Okay. But I don't want to assume everybody here understands what it is. So agorism is an idea that is attributed to a guy named Samuel Konkin. And it's the idea that basically there are two ways of interacting with people, violently or cooperatively, violently or peacefully. And the marketplace is where we interact peacefully, and the state is where we interact violently. So we want to minimize the violence, maximize the peace. And his approach to doing that is a non-political one, whereby we withdraw consent or we just start doing things in defiance of the state. And that can come with small acts of rebellion, like driving past the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, or having a garage sale and not reporting the receipts to the IRS, things like that. And then building up, as you build networks with people, building up to larger and larger, what he calls a counter economy. And so the question is, what are the prospects for that? Now, Rothbard, Konkin was a Rothbardian in his theory, but in this practical recommendation, he had a dispute with Rothbard, who thought this can go only so far, that how could you do heavy industry? Realistic with, you know, you could maybe grow bananas and sell them to your neighbor, but you know, how are you going to do that with heavy industry? And secondly, he says some things do require political action. Like there was no way agorism was going to shut down the Second Bank of the United States. That happened because President Jackson refused to renew its charter. That was a political action. Or by and large, the end of slavery did not come about because of slave revolts. It came about because of a politically orchestrated movement. So that was his answer. So what do you think about that?
No, I'm inclined to agree with it. First of all, the agorist thing of let's be bold and brazen and, as it were, go beyond the limits and the transgression that are set for us in various ways. I find that appeals to me, okay? And I better not say it here because we're on record, but I might have done this in various ways, small ways and so on. And we all tend to do it, living dangerously and so on. But Rothbard is absolutely right on this in a sense. This can contribute to, I think, the elevation of morale and keep you going when times are sort of tough and so on. But as a possible instrument or a force for overall transformation I can't see that happening. Because to do so, it has to become visible and it has to become apparent. And once it becomes visible and apparent and becomes a threat to the state and the powers that be, then you're in a fight. And again, given the difference in force between the combatants here, you're going to lose.
Yeah. Well, I say let people try what they want to try. And we'll see what goes where.
Yeah.
No problem.
And the last person to post after anybody's phone, go for it.
Okay. I think with that, we'll call it a day and thank everybody. I mentioned a bit cryptically in an email that we have another course coming out from our friend, Professor Rechtenwald. He initially was going to do a history of the environmental movement. And now what he's done is he's merged that with an overview of the so-called Great Reset and combined them into one thing.
Interesting.
So I think you'll all enjoy that. So I'll let you know as soon as that is up. But for those of you in the United States, I hope you're having a pleasant day off from work. And for those of you who are in Ireland and retired, I hope you're having a pleasant day off from work.
Well, I wasn't until I came on here.
Zing. Anyway, thanks, everybody. We'll see you next month. Thank you, Professor Casey.
All right. God bless, Tom. God bless everybody.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that. Tomorrow, our old friend Naomi Brockwell returns to talk privacy and what you can do. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.